constantly talking isn't necessarily communicating.
Why do I fall in love with every woman I see who shows me the least bit of attention?
She's not looking at me. She's busy. No one ever looks at me. I want my mommy.
I can't remember anything without you. Aw, that's sweet. Very sweet. But try.
I'm not perfect. I can't see anything that I don't like about you. But you will think of things, and I'll get bored of you and feel trapped because that's what happens with me. Okay.
Is there any risk of brain damage? Well, technically speaking, the operation is brain damage, but it's on par with a night of heavy drinking. Nothing you'll miss.
While there's a lot you may want to forget, you definitely don't want to forget this dream-inducing glass of film on the rocks.
Very smooth. Very smooth. I like it.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to Film on the Rocks, everybody. I'm Levi, and I'm joined by my good buddy, Brooker. Brooker, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Excited to talk about this movie.
Me too, man. Me too. Today, we are looking at the 2004 strange, artistic, different movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It was directed by Michel Gondry. I hope I'm saying that right. It won an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. It was nominated for Best Actress in Kate Winslet, or Supporting Actress, I guess.
Oh, nice.
It was had a budget of around $20 million and grossed a worldwide $74 million. So it did very well for itself. I really like this movie. I have never. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit strange. It stars a lot. Actually, a very interesting cast of characters: Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, Elijah Wood, Mark Ruffalo, a young Mark Ruffalo, David Cross, Kristen Dunst, Tom Wilkinson. There's a whole. This is a pretty star-studded movie, Brooker.
Definitely is, and kind of like what we talked about on our Jim Carrey minisode. This was definitely a situation much like you, how you said I was like, oh my god, that's Mark Ruffalo, that's Kristen Dunst. I was just like, who all is in this movie, and why has it taken me so long to finally watch it?
I'm glad you said something about that, Brooker, about how it was like a star-studded cast, because this movie for me was that of how whenever we were doing our Jim Carrey rankings. Again, I won't spoil what my list was. You'll have to go watch the minisode we did a couple weeks earlier. Pause this, go check it out, come back. But this one was my number two on the list, and I was just so impressed with how many stars were just crammed into this movie. And I just, oh my gosh, there's Kristen Dunst, there's Elijah Wood, oh my goodness, you know, a very young Mark Ruffalo. And I'd never seen this episode until recently. Brooker, before I start jumping in, what is your history with this movie?
It was in preparation for our Jim Carrey rankings, and this was I've kind of like seen this movie before, or not seen it, but like I've seen it floated around in like just like discussions about movies and whatnot, but I've never actually seen it, and I had no idea what it was about. And so when we were doing the Jim Carrey rankings, I kind of saw how this had just rave reviews. I was like, all right, well, I guess I got to like watch it so I'll get like a proper ranking, I guess. And I was just blown away. This movie was awesome. And I remember within like the first 6 minutes of the movie, Kat was watching it. My girlfriend's watching it with me. And she kind of just like looked up some information on it. She goes, oh, this movie says on IMDb, it has it classified as a sci-fi movie. I was like, sci-fi? What? And then, you know, the plot unveiled itself. I was like, oh wow, this is so cool and so fun, and it's quite a whirlwind, because I think this is the least linear movie I've ever watched.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Same thing with me. I watched this originally because we were doing the Jim Carrey ranking, and for a lot of the lists that I saw of like Jim Carrey's best work, this was always in the top 10, always in the top 10, 95% of the time in the top 5, and a lot of these lists had it like as number 1 or number 2 or number 3. Which I would agree with after seeing all these movies, just from an unbiased perspective. I like looking at the, as you know, like looking at the Rotten Tomatoes score before I jump in, just to kind of see what people have said. This one got a 93% tomato meter and a 94% audience score. And so I had high hopes for this movie, and it absolutely delivered.
Absolutely. And I totally agree. This absolutely deserved that big nine in front of that Rotten Tomato score.
Mm.
Just because you kind of said, I had this movie in my top five as well. I had it at number three.
Yeah. And it, you know, and it deserves that spot, absolutely. This movie was so interesting, too, because, as we've talked about, Jim Carrey being the front runner, or one of the front runners of this movie, is known for his wacky, goofy kind of center of attention, bending his body all different places, contorting his face into all of these different shapes and things. And he is not that at all. There's not even much of a goofy bone in his body in this movie. Weirdly enough, Gondry would tell everyone on cast, he's apparently a big fan of improvising. And this director, from what I've looked up, doesn't have a ton of like huge movies that he's been a part of. He did The Green Hornet, which I did not see, but apparently it kind of crashed to the critics. It did not do a great job, but he's done a lot of short films, some foreign films, because he is a Frenchman, so he kind of dabbles in his own language. But apparently he is a huge fan of improvising, which Jim Carrey is the poster child of improvisation. Especially in the modern day, I would say he's one of the best improvisers of all time, still alive today. With that caveat, I would say that he's healthily in the top three, just comedic improvisers. But Michelle, or I should say the Gondry, actually told the staff, or the cast, to improvise except for Jim Carrey. He would go up to Kate Winslet and he would say something along the lines of, "Hey, this is a comedy, it's funny, it's goofy, be silly, be, you know, feel free to just say stuff." And to Jim Carrey, he would say, "This is a drama, it's serious, we are down, so don't branch out." And apparently Jim Carrey had a lot of frustration while filming this, because he was kind of...
Oh, really?
He said, "Stick to the script, we have your lines, say what you need to say," but everybody else was supposed to go off script. So you were kind of... Jim Carrey was kind of put in a box in a lot of respects, and yet... He shines so brightly.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the director coming up to him going, "Hey, I'm going to have you do something that's outside your wheelhouse, and I'm going to have you do it with an arm tied behind your back." But that's interesting. I did see that that kind of like what you're saying, that there was a lot of improvisation in this, especially with Mark Ruffalo and Elijah Wood. Most of their back and forth was improvised. I did see that... for Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet, they didn't help write the script, but they kind of helped write the dialogue between them, because they had a lot of time to themselves as actors to prepare for the movie. And so they each talked about certain big fights that they've had in past relationships, like big meltdowns and heartbreaks that they've had, and also just like fun or funny like childhood memories that they kind of think about occasionally, that just like randomly pop in their heads. You know, like sometimes when you're sleeping, you just have this random, like, why am I thinking about that time I like crashed my bike when I was five right now? So some of their practices and rehearsals from those meetings through osmosis just came into the script.
Yeah, and it gave it that natural feel. The conversation and the dialogue feels very real, feels very natural. And that was a lot of what Gondry was trying to go for. And, you know, I'll touch on some other stuff down the road, but a lot of the effects were practical. The dialogue was very natural. Like even the scene where the house is like the tide is coming in and there's that house that they're going to on the beach and the tide is kind of flowing in. They didn't, you know, CGI, like they just built a house really close to the ocean and let the tide come in. Whenever they were on the lake that was frozen, it wasn't a, "Oh, okay, we gotta, you know, build a fro." They just, in New York, It happened to be a really cold winter and the lake froze over. And so they filmed it on an actually frozen lake. And it became one of the, you know, more famous scenes. That like shot of them laying on their back on the on this lake is like the most famous image of that movie.
Yeah, no, that's super cool. And something I saw too, you know, a lot of practical, just like in camera things that they would do. Because as we develop into, or as we progress into the plot of this movie, you know, there's lots of Jim Carrey running around his memories or dreams, and lots of, he's just falling around like Kate Winslet or Clementine, and she'll disappear in one room and appear in the other. And like, this wasn't some sort of like special effect trick. They just had like trap doors and people running around very fast. I saw that there was even one of the scenes where Joel is watching himself in the doctor's office. And that wasn't like, they didn't have like a double or any sort of like, any other sort of like special effects for that. They literally just had Jim Carrey quickly going back and forth, taking his hat on and off, just back and forth real quick to get that done. And it's just like, you had to be in tremendous shape to be in this film, I'm sure. So much running around.
Oh, no, that's so true. That's so true. But it made it feel so real. You mentioned the dreams. I'm curious, before we get into drinking rules, and I believe you mentioned this in our Jim Carrey ranking video, you believe that this movie represents dreams in a better way than Inception did, like as far as how dreams are supposed to be or supposed to represent themselves, which is Inception is kind of that quintessential movie about dreams. Oh, Inception, because you go in a dream, in a dream, in a dream, in a dream. Explain, I would agree with you. Short answer, I agree with you. Long answer, why do you think that they did dreams better in this one than they did in the quintessential dream movie of Inception?
So I have a reason why, but I also wonder if I misspoke, because this is something that I'm having a hard time saying. Like, are they dreams or are they memories? Or are they memories in his dreams? Because they're erasing memories, but he's asleep, kind of going through all these memories. So are they dreams or are they like just memories while he's dreaming? I'm having a headache just thinking about it.
I mean, technically, every memory you have is a memory of a memory. So I guess they can be dreams. Like, that in and of itself, like everything that you remember in your brain is, and I'm sure you know this as the scientist, every memory you have in your brain is not 100% accurate because you are remembering a time that you remembered a memory or however many times removed. So I guess in a lot of ways they are dreams. I don't know. I'm kind of stretching a little bit, but Yeah, the memory part, would you say that, because in a lot of ways, you know, not to give away the whole plot of Inception, there is a level of him remembering because they're trying to dig something out of his brain, but they're going into his dreams to pull out a memory. I don't know.
Yeah. So let's pretend, to answer your question, finally. So like with Inception, everything was kind of perfect. Like you were in the world, you saw like all the projections, there's like the background people in Inception, like they had faces, they had full features and everything, but, and so did all the buildings and sidewalks. But in here, in, so like for example, Joel never saw Patrick's face. He can't really place what his face looks like. He could just only see the back of his head. Or, like, maybe he sees what he thinks might be his eyes, but they're placed wrong on the face because he's, like, trying so hard to construct a face he hasn't seen before. And I was like, oh, that's what it's like. Because I remember, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I've had so many dreams where I've woken up, like, oh, had this dream, but there's a person in there that I don't know who they are. And I had this conversation with them, but I, for the love of me, cannot picture what they looked like. And I had this whole dream about this.
Like, I've seen them before, and I remember them being a real person. I just don't remember them much out of the fact that I remember seeing them.
Right. Yeah. Like, I could, like, maybe picture the hair, and that's about it. I can't picture any facial features. And this has happened to me a couple of times. So I was like, oh, that, like, really got to me. When I was watching, it's like, oh, I've experienced this. I know what that feels like. It felt like a dream, like stuff that like doesn't make sense. Like, I'm pretty sure you've had like weird dreams before. You're like, man, I just had a dream where like I was a kid again. My mom was taking care of me, but I was like the same body that I am right now. It was weird. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's like parts of this movie where he like goes back to his childhood, but he's still adult Jim Carrey body. Just, mm-hmm. but everything's like bigger to him and whatnot. I don't know. It just felt like, yeah, this is, I just watching this, like, this is what dreams do feel like,
yeah,
actually.
A memory. Yeah. Kind of being put into a memory in itself is kind of like being in a dream. So they're kind of, they can kind of go back and forth. And it, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned that, you know, Inception and kind of all that, you know, a few weeks ago, because apparently there was some stress over this. This movie was, you know, came out in 2004. There was another little known movie called Memento by Christopher Nolan.
Oh, that's a good one.
I won't spoil it, obviously. It's such a good movie. Brooker and I are both big Nolan fans. But in short, the themes of this movie surround memory or the lack thereof. And when it came out, Gondry, you know, was preparing and kind of creating the idea of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and was very sure that he had to cancel production just kind of cancel the process of getting this movie made. Because he was so sure with how popular Memento was, he said, "Oh, ours is going to come out. Ours is about memory as well. It's just going to be carbon copy. It's going to be old news. No one's going to see it or whatever." And he had the people around him pushing him to do it, and so he ended up doing it. But there was a period of time where that almost didn't happen because, you know, Christopher Nolan did the whole memory thing so well. Again, not going to spoil it, but if you haven't seen it, you should totally see it.
And again, a very non-linear movie as well.
Built very similarly to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Very similarly in a lot of ways.
I wonder if that delayed the production of this movie. Because I wonder if he had the maybe like part of the script or like the thought to start writing the script around the same time. Because Memento came out in 2000. This came out in 2004. So I wonder if maybe he just decided, maybe let's just wait a few years and then do it so that way it's not like two memory movies back to back. But
maybe he found out about the production of Memento in 1999 and it came out in 2000. That must have been what it was. Okay, so Brooker, let's just dive into drinking rules. I'm very curious to see. I feel like we might have some overlaps for this movie, but just because it's so, you know, the beautiful thing of having a movie like this, there's not a lot of repetition. It's so random and it's continuing on, rolling and rolling. You don't experience a lot of things over and over again. But at the same time, there are some things you can do. What were your drinking rules for this movie?
Okay. So I think that this is the most difficult movie that we've covered, just first off, because this is a very artsy movie, like we've said, and it's pretty serious at times, and like you said, there are some repetitive things, but I wanted to try to be a little bit more unique than just like picking some things but that are obvious. But that being said, one of my first obvious rules would be whenever Clementine's hair changes, take a drink. And that's actually something that I love. It's a very clever plot device in this movie, and I don't mean to, but I'm kind of making parallels to Inception again. So like in Inception, there's those three layers, when they go in the dream of the dream of the dream, and one's in a hotel, one's in a snow fortress, and one is in a city during the rain. So you have rain, hotel interior, and snow. So just by like quickly seeing what the environment looks like, you automatically know as the audience what layer of the dream you're in. And they did that with Clementine's hair. They did that so that way you can tell what part in their relationship they're currently in, just by the color of her hair, which I thought was excellent. You know, when it's green, it's at the very beginning of the relationship. That's when they first meet. It's orange, tangerine during their relationship, and it's blue when it's the relationship is over and she's wiped her memory. So that was, to me, I thought that was very clever to use that as like, okay, this is how we're going to give the audience a little bone here so that way they could keep up what's going on. So I really liked that. I thought that was very clever. But whenever her hair changes, take a drink. I also had, Patrick, played by Elijah Wood, is an asshole. Yeah. So whenever you're just like going, wow, fuck Patrick, take a drink.
And it's,
which happens,
and it's so weird too, because this is shortly after he finished Lord of the Rings. This is just like a couple years after. I believe that's right. I think if they finished in 2003, I believe. I'll double check that. But that's so weird that he went from one of the, like, Return of the King, one of the biggest movies in human history. You know, still, I think he still holds the record or tied the record for the most Oscar wins of all time. And I think it has the record for most noms. I'm not sure. But just destroyed at the box office. And then he's like, oh, now Eternal Sunshine. And he plays just like this terrible person.
Yeah, it's very much just him being like, you know what? I did the hero role for 3 movies, which, you know, is probably like a total of like 12 hours of him being the hero role. He's like, you know what? I'm just going to be like this goofy fuckboy.
Yeah, right.
And just pal around with Mark Ruffalo. So especially when he's talking about how, when he's first telling Mark Ruffalo how he's dating Clementine and how he stole a pair of her underwear while they were doing the memory extraction. I was like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah.
I was like, Mark Ruffalo, you need to punch him in the face right now.
Yep.
And also, whenever we see him use any of Joel's, like, I don't say tricks because they're like Joel's like genuine courtship with Clementine, all like the sweet things he would say to her, do for her, but he's using them now for his own personal gain. I was just like, oh god, I hate this guy.
Yeah, it's terrible.
I just drink every time. You're like, god, fuck Patrick. My third drinking rule is, so the memory or sleep technicians were really funny and kind of like good comic relief out of this, as much as I just like pooped on Patrick, but he does leave the movie for like a little bit in the middle. So when Kristen Dunst, Mary, when she comes over and she's hanging out with Mark Ruffalo, whatnot, there's like this point in the movie where they are getting drunk or high and they're like dancing, but every time we come back, we cut back to them, they're missing more and more clothing. So I had drink every time we cut back to them and there's like an item of clothing missing. So drink for every item of clothing. So for like the first one, Kristen Dunst, she's not wearing pants and her bra's gone. And then the second time, Mark Ruffalo's shirt and pants are gone. And then eventually we see Mark Ruffalo's butt. So so just drink every time they progressively become more nude.
Yeah, yeah.
My fourth drinking rule, which I'm calling the cover rule, the movie cover rule.
Okay.
So drink whenever they're on that frozen pond,
because
that happens a couple of times.
The movie cover rule. So anytime you see the shot that is on the cover of the movie, you take a drink. I love that.
It's kind of like that whole thing. Like, oh, they said the title of the movie. So that's why this is called Eternal Sunshine. This pilot. It's kind of like that, but it's like the cover art. And then my last drinking rule is drink whenever the voices of the technicians seep into Joel's dreams.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which happens a couple of times.
Those are good, Brooker. I like those. Yeah, that movie cover rule. I like that a lot. Those are good. We only overlapped on, weirdly enough, we only overlapped on one of them. I thought we would overlap more.
Ooh, let me guess. Is it Clementine's hair?
Yes, it is.
Hair?
It is Clementine's hair. Okay, which, by the way, I thought they dyed her hair. They used wigs. They were wigs.
Really?
Yeah. Did not realize that until I started doing research. Just every time Clem has a new color in her hair, take a drink. And this is like shot by shot. So whenever you see orange, you know, she can change from to like green to blue and then back to orange. And if she goes back to orange, you still have to take another drink. It's not like, oh, I saw orange, I don't have to drink again. No. Every time it changes, take a drink. Which I did not realize until you said it, that it was a way to keep time, to be like, orange is the middle, blue is the end, green is the beginning. That is so good. I admire that. I also had, every time Joel is referred to as boring, take a drink, which is more often than you think.
I like it.
He is either by himself, Clem, or somebody else, where, it could be the word bored or bore or boring, just some sort of form of that word. Take a drink.
Like being predictable.
Predictable, you can count that too. Any synonym to boring, which, you know, predictable isn't necessarily boring, but I think in his world, I think he kind of sees that as boring. I had a drink every time a new memory starts up in Joel's head. So when he's getting his memories erased, ooh, and you transition into a new memory, take a drink.
That's fun.
Yeah, which is fun because it is kind of trying to decide, are we switching to a new memory or is this still the same memory? Because like whenever he's in the doctor's office, I think there's a scene where he kind of rewinds and fast forwards a little bit between kind of like goes from room to room and he's experiencing new things. Like, is that all the same memory? Is it a new memory? Make the judgment for yourself. Mm. But every time there's a new memory, take a drink.
I guess it's kind of like, how would you put it in a journal? Today, I went to the doctor's office, and these are the events that happened.
Yes.
Or would you have, like, a separate journal entry for, like, I went to this room, and then this happened, and then I went to this room, next page.
Right, that's true. Or they could have been, like, his consultation is the first meeting, and then he had, like, the actual surgery, or, like, the operation on the other day. Also, drink every time Naomi, which is Joel's ex, every time Naomi's mentioned, take a drink.
Ooh, that's a good catch.
Which apparently she was in a couple deleted scenes. One was while they were together, and one was apparently like a post-breakup hookup or something like that. So she was almost in the movie, but she was not in the final edit.
Dude, how many like bar trivia nights do you think have been like won because somebody knew Naomi's name? Because you asked me right now, who is Jim Carrey's like fiance in this movie? I'm dead. I don't know.
Were they engaged? I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, I think that they were engaged or just like maybe like in a serious relationship. But he was kind of cheating when he first met Clementine.
Yeah, kind of.
But yeah, that's a trivia fact that I'm pretty sure has won many bar trivia nights for some people.
Yeah. Everybody remember Naomi, Joel's ex-girlfriend or ex-fiance, whatever. The last one is my favorite, and this one is going to be unique to each and every one of you guys. Drink every time something happens in this movie that you can relate to, in a relational sense, whether it is a breakup or whether it is, you know, trying to move past a breakup, the feeling of a painful memory or just kind of the renew at the end. I thought about this just looking up some fun facts about this movie. Apparently, while Michel Gondry was, you know, while the editing process was in full effect, for this movie, Gondry's serious girlfriend left him. And so to this day, or at least whenever this quote came out, he will not. It is too sad for him to watch this movie. He will not watch this movie because it is too sad for him to watch. Don't know if it's still true. Don't know if he's healed from that yet. But he has a hard time watching this movie. The scene where Joel is gathering up all of Naomi's stuff that he's in, you know, putting it in a box to like throw away and everything. Gondry always thought that was something that was like a faux pas, like, oh, that's not real. That's just kind of something you have to put in because everyone expects it. But then when it happened to him, he was like, that is real. Any little thing in your life that you see that reminds you it is painful, it hurts, you have to get, you know, I had to get rid of it. Like, that's so real. And so if you see something like that where you were like, man, I relate to that on a real level, take a drink. You know, to a certain extent, if this is a drink of sadness, maybe hold off on the drink. But if it's a drink of post-healing where you're like, oh, yeah, I can relate to that, then take a drink. Obviously, you know. No pain numbing, but we, Brooker, I wanted to ask, this is a more serious question, but was there anything in this movie, you know, don't want to force you to get crazy personal, but like, you know, breakups happen, hurt relationships or whatever. Like, is there anything in this movie that you are like, yeah, I can relate to that? Like, if you've been through a breakup or know someone who's been through a breakup or helped somebody through something like that or a painful relationship or a reconciliation or something where you're like, man, that felt so real when I watched it. Kind of putting you on the spot a little bit.
Trying to think. I mean, I kind of had, like, just on the same note, I mean, yes, I've been through breakups before. Mm-hmm. And, like, my current girlfriend, we've been dating for 10 years, and we broke up, like, I don't know, two or three times our first year dating. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get all this, but from a slightly different stakes. But, I mean, you know, it sucks. And that's something that the last drinking rule you're talking about with the, you know, getting rid of everything that reminds you of this person. Mm-hmm. I really liked how methodical and how they had a whole protocol of how to, this is how you are going to forget this person. Mm-hmm. And besides, like, the literal memory wipe, everything is kind of like, this is what people do. You know, you get rid of everything. Your best friend, who's, like, you know, helping you out through all this, yeah, texts everyone else that they know that you're going to come in contact with, like, hey, so-and-so just broke up with, you know, this person. Don't mention them. Don't mention them to this person while we're around. Right. We're going to go out tonight. Do not bring them up. If you bring them up, I'm going to kill you. So, you know, we got to help our buddy out. And, you know, we kind of see how his two friends, his friends that are like a married couple, they get a letter from this clinic saying, like, hey, Joel has been erased from Clementine's memory. Do not bring up Joel to Clementine if you see her. Thank you for your cooperation or whatever.
Right.
So it's kind of like we get all like the same elements that we normally all go through for breakups or whatever. And then the whole memory extraction. I don't know if I would ever actually want any of my memories to just be wiped away. Maybe some like embarrassing things that I've done. I'm like, oh God, this would help me sleep better if I could just forget about this embarrassing thing. Mm. But yeah, I don't think that there's any sort of relationship, you know, either platonic or more so, that I would want erased. I mean, I think I like, you learn from everything, right? Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say so. And I'll touch more on that whenever we get to the meaning of the film. Cause I think you are kind of hitting the nail on the head on multiple sides. The scene that really stood out to me, kind of transitioning into scenes, but also on the whole thing of things that you relate to. Rachel and I have been married for going on, it's, you know, we're at, coming up on 2.5 years. We've been together for seven and a half. So we've been doing this, not as long as y'all have, but we're getting close. And there's a moment at the end that, really touched me, where he is remembering that night where they go to the old house on the beach, and he talks about how he left, and he talks about how he wished he would have stayed, and she says, then stay, and he's like knees on the ground and he's looking up at her and he's like, I love you, and then the kiss, and it's like, oh, it's just such a sweet scene. I thought, I've been thinking a ton about that, and I think a lot about that, about regret, about, you know, mistakes, not that you wish you could have back because they're embarrassing, but mistakes you wish you could have back because either you've hurt someone or you've hurt yourself or whatever. And just, that is so real. Like, the most tangible example, without getting crazy, crazy serious, is like, I mean, I think about, you know, if you love someone dearly, you're going to, you know, you're going to fight. You're going to have disagreements. Clinically speaking, or I guess scientifically speaking, if you do not fight, that is a bad sign for your relationship. It is good that you have disagreements, because that means that you care enough to voice concerns to somebody. If you don't, you know, granted that if you don't fight, that doesn't mean you guys are doomed as a relationship. But it is, statistically speaking, it is. The statistics are with you to stay together if you have fought on some level. But if we, you know, if Rachel and I have some sort of disagreement and I kind of like will walk away, or she'll walk away, and we'll have like, we'll, you know, kind of be apart for a little bit, I think back to those moments, you know, and sometimes it's good to take a breather, but those moments where you're just kind of mad at each other for a few days. And I always wish that I could have those days back. Just because it's days of either of me being stubborn or, you know, and I can't control her, obviously. So it's just all on me of like what I could have done, me being stubborn, me sitting there and be like, well, she should apologize to me, or she needs to make the first move, and be like, no, I should have taken the first move, because, you know, when I'm 98 years old, am I going to look back and be like, I'm so glad that I spent those 2 days not speaking to my wife. I can guarantee you, right. I'm going to say no, and I'm going to regret it. And those moments of him being like, I'm going to stay. I was like, man, that's good. That is so good. So that's encouragement. If you guys ever have that moment where you're like, maybe I should just, why not? I mean, if like, you know, just stay.
That's so funny. I mean, not funny, but I love how you're getting this very like emotional kind of this scene is touching you emotionally, and for me I was like, oh man, that sucks, because you know he's walking away, he's like, but I didn't stay, I have no memory of this, like there's, it ends here, I don't have anything to go for, so I'm just going to walk away and hit Clementine. It's like, well, we can make a new memory. And I was like, oh, that's like very touching and everything, but I was still just like flabbergasted, like the house is crumbling, sand is coming in, water is coming into the house, like this is awesome, this looks great. And I love like the visual storytelling, because I kind of took it as the water coming into the house and like coming around his ankles and everything. It was like visualizing this flooding guilt or regret he had for not staying, and that was kind of like what he was being filled with. And it's so good. It's a really cool, touching scene. But yeah, that's kind of like, I was still just like floored, but like, oh, this visually is awesome. I love the storytelling that they're going on, that they're doing here.
This 100%. Kind of like the house is crumbling, like the memory is crumbling. It's like the last kind of like fulcrum of his memory with Clem, and he's holding on, but it's crumbling around him and he can't hold on to it. Yeah, no, I think I agree. What other scenes? Let's just jump into scenes that were kind of, since we've already kind of transitioned to it anyway. Other than that big ending scene that we've kind of touched on, unless there's more you want to touch on, what are some scenes that you've been like, oh, that was so much fun, or oh, that was great, or that was amazing?
I do have some like funny notes, but we could say that for towards the end. But for scenes, I kind of, this movie flows so well, so it's kind of hard for me to pick out, you know, this part when this happens, because it's kind of like, this movie just flows so well, it's hard to dissect out like certain segments of it. So I kind of had this broken up into like two sections, like just Joel's journey into trying to keep Clementine's memory or memories of Clementine, and then the outside world of the technicians goofing off. So for like Joel's journey, I really love this point that we get to where it's him, and this is memory of him and Clementine walking through the woods during the day, and they're like surrounded by, it looks like it's during the fall because there's just leaves everywhere, and he's like trying to tell her, hey, I'm the erasers are trying to, you know, erase you, we need to try to come up with a plan and everything. And she's like, so they're kind of like getting into like a little argument or whatever. And but what I love about this is that it's Joel talking to himself. Like, Clementine isn't there because it's a memory. It's a memory of Clementine. We're learning who Clementine is through Joel's perspective. And I love this conversation between them two, because Joel says to the effect of, you know, we're just in this situation because of you. She goes, I'm sorry. You know I'm impulsive.
Oh, yeah.
And he forgives her. And it's like him talking to himself, like, hey man, you can forgive her for this, because you know who Clementine is, you know that this is so Clementine, and this is why you love her. And they even talk about some things that he loves about her right here. And it's so, I love it, because it's Joel reminding himself why he loves Clementine.
But yes, I agree that scene is incredible. I'm glad you caught that, the whole level of, it was him talking to himself, because Clem's not going to be like, you know me, I'm impulsive. Yeah, like, you're right, I am terrible because I'm impulsive. But him kind of talking to himself and being like, this is what I think about you, but also that level of like, but you can forgive her. I had, you know, that scene, that whole dream sequence is amazing. And specifically, I just got the biggest kick out of Joel as a baby. I love that. It's so funny. I love it. It's just, it's so funny. Like the baby Joel.
Joel.
Because you're coming from his mind as a child, remembering this childlike memory of, and you get, you kind of get to see Joel as, you know, from the very inside. Cause I'm a firm believer of this. We adults are still children. Like, we are just taller, more mature children. We have the same, in essence, the same fears, the same hilarity. We've just kind of matured to the point where, you know, we know we're not supposed to, you know, we have to wash our hands. We have to, you know, we can't laugh at fart jokes in front of other adults because that's immature, but like, we still chuckle at it or whatever. So it's kind of him being like I said earlier, you know, why is no one looking at me? Everyone's too busy for me. Nobody loves me. Ugh, I just want mom. I want to be in mom's arms. And his, the only moment in this whole process where he feels like he's relaxed is when he's being held by his mom and bathed in the sink. And he just is like,
Yeah.
I'm at peace because I know that my mom is being attentive to me, is taking the time to be with me, is taking the time to take care of me. And so you see Joel as this person who, and this is what he is, he just wants to be loved. He just wants to be loved on. And, you know, you kind of get to see him. And it's just a funny little scene where we see Clem kind of like, baby Joel. It's not Joel. It's baby Joel. And she's commenting on the, man, this kitchen is amazing. Ooh, I love this dress. And he's rolling around under the table being like, I'm so afraid. You know, it's just that whole scene I thought was so cool to kind of to the psyche of Joel as an infant, but also just the creativity and the practical effects of it. It was very, the kind of the same idea as how they did it in Lord of the Rings, where Joel is standing far away and the table is big. And then we have Clem kind of standing farther back and it looks like she's taller, and very practical, very cool effects.
Yeah, it's great. My favorite thing from that scene is that Clementine, who is kind of like taking the position of Joel's mother's friend in this like conversation, and what's funny is that she's keeping up the conversation with his mom as like his mother's friend. And hold on, I was thinking, why is she doing this? Like this doesn't need to happen. It's like it's just a memory. Like, his mom is gonna be like, hey, yeah, something suspicious, are you sleeping? Like, I was like, why is she keeping up with the conversation? Yeah. So it was kind of cracking me up that they were doing that. And I loved the transition between memories of how we got to this one, because the prior one was Joel and Clementine were hanging out on the pullout couch, and Clementine is like coming up with the idea like, hey, this is a memory where they would want to go, because this was a memory where you look at my crotch and you wanted to have sex, and this is a very Clementine memory. They're going to come here. We need to go somewhere else where they wouldn't think to look for Clementine memories. And this is when we see the transition. He thought about like a rainy day and starts raining in there. And then the table turns into like this tin roof for a little bit. And it's so cool. And then we fully transition into this kitchen memory of him hiding underneath the kitchen table while his mom talked to one of her girlfriends. It's so cool. I love it.
Yeah, that whole dream sequence is very, very impressive. I thought they did that. I did a really, really good job with that. And you know, I'll put a pin in that whole topic about the dreams. I got a question for you here in a second. But any other scenes that you really enjoyed?
Yes. Basically, I loved all of like the seamless transitions that they did. Was great. The first one that like got me, I was like, whoa! This movie's sick. Was when Joel went to Barnes & Noble to give Clementine like an apology, and she like doesn't recognize him or anything. He's just devastated, and he walks out straight into his best friend's living room.
Yeah.
And as you see him walk, go through the threshold, the door, the Barnes & Noble lights just shut down, and it's just like, whoa, that was super cool. That really stuck out to me. And the technicians, this whole B plot with them was comical, but at the same time, I was kind of like, I don't know if we need this whole weird love story with Mary and Howard, but whatever. That being said, I did like seeing the process of how they went about this, but I was kind of cracking up just seeing Kristen Dunst and Mark Ruffalo half naked, just dancing over unconscious Jim Carrey. Like, could you imagine being like Kristen Dunst or Mark Ruffalo right now in like 2004? Like, okay, I'm just going to act like an asshole in front of comedy legend Jim Carrey right now for
that whole relationship. I agree with you. There was some level to their kind of B plot where you're kind of like, it doesn't need to be here. But at the same time, kind of Stan and Mary's relationship and the fact that Mary was in love with the doctor, and Stan would, you know, kind of scooped her up, is on the kind of on the same level that Patrick kind of scooped up Clem after her memory got erased to a certain extent. And so I kind of, as it closed, I was like, it's kind of this like reflection of,
to an extent,
even the doctor recognizes that this isn't a perfect process and there are bumps in the road. And it's kind of funny seeing Stan, Mark Ruffalo's character, being like, you shouldn't do that, Patrick, this is a terrible idea. And then by the end, I was like, you dingus, you did the same thing. What are you talking about?
Yeah, the B plot with them, it serves its purpose. It serves its purpose because it kind of shows some of the dangers of this and the consequences. Sure. I would have wished that we kind of saw maybe some other examples that weren't people wanting to forget somebody that they just broke up with. Like, I don't know, like, I just bombed this interview, please just wipe this from my memory, or something like that. You know, something a little bit more lighthearted, or things that, like, because there's other things, but this really kind of seems to be like the heart mending clinic.
Yeah, they did have that one lady that was in there with like dog toys, which was not a person. And so it kind of gave it another level of them being like, she's trying to forget she's like an older woman who lost her pet. And
it's still a broken heart.
Still a broken heart. I agree. Yeah. So it's still kind of it's in the same quadrant, but a little bit different. I think my favorite scene in the whole movie, and this was like one of the first ones we saw, was the train scene at the beginning, where you kind of get to see Clem and Joel interact for the first time, and she just is talking his ear off, and the guy is clearly enthralled by her and is just enjoying her company, but also doesn't know what to do. Sitting there and not really knowing what to do as she's talking his ear off. He's just minding his own business, but she clearly is kind of attached to him, and he's kind of getting attached to her, and they kind of slowly but surely meld together. And she says something like, I'm going to sleep at your house. And he's like, okay. And it's just like, kind of falls into his life.
I love it because it's such good symmetry showing the both the beginning, because they show how the relationship began and then how it began again here when she has blue hair. It's her approaching him both times.
Yep.
And it's him just like, the first time when they were in there at the beach, he's like, I don't even want to be here. I'm just here because my friends drugged me here, but I saw you had an orange sweater on and I thought that was really cool. And then here, same thing, he's like attracted to her for just whatever reason, but again, she's approaching him and bothering him and, you know, just poking at him and whatnot. So I love the symmetry of, like, it's almost like destiny, like, almost. It's kind of like, this is inevitable. This is just how you two are attracted to each other, and this is how it works.
Mm. And you kind of get to see, I don't know, I was talking to Rachel about this, but this is kind of when you see Kate Winslet is playing this character in Clem, and she's kind of this archetype of a manic pixie dream girl. Does that term ring a bell for you?
No.
Okay. So in essence, and this is, you know, with a movie we're doing down the road, we're kind of going to see an example of this again. In essence, it's this archetype in film where typically a female character, I guess it could be a male, like a manic pixie dream boy is also a thing, but a lot of times it's a girl, is depicted as this like quirky, lively personality whose purpose is to kind of inspire an appreciation for life and beauty and extravagance in kind of the protagonist. And so a lot of times the like Manic Pixie Dream Girl has like different color hair and different piercings and different tattoos. And it's like, I don't care. I'm going to play in the fountain in the middle of the city. I don't care. I'm going to do cartwheels in the highway. I don't care. I'm going to lay down on a frozen lake. Like, who cares? And Joel is like, no. This is how the world's supposed to go. And he's like, I don't care. I'm going to live my life. You know, not like, it's not ignorance. It's just like appreciating life for what it is. Let's run on this frozen lake because it's frozen and it could hold our weight. And that might be fun. I'm going to change my hair because color is beautiful and I want everyone to see me. And, you know, and it's, you kind of see this, again, that's kind of a reoccurring theme. I know some people say that like, Jess from New Girl kind of fits that Manic Pixie Dream Girl archetype. Breakfast at Tiffany's. There's a kind of a Manic Pixie Dream Girl theme in that, of what a lot of people have said. We're going to see Ramona from Scott Pilgrim versus the World kind of fits that archetype as well, which we'll cover that down the road. But you kind of see her playing against this straight man that is Jim Carrey of, you know, not even just orderly, but just, again, boring. And it's just so fun, right? Because you experience their characters in their fullness on that train ride. And it's just so, so much fun.
Yeah, no, I love it. I feel like there's a couple of drinking rules here, too, that I didn't think of that we could do. But whenever, because in this train ride, Joel is in his journal, like whenever, so that could be a drinking rule, whenever Joel opens up his journal and is like reading in it or writing in it, which he does a couple of times. But that sounds like a great definition, or just a great way to describe how Clementine is, just this bouncy person that just does what they want to do and doesn't really care what other people think.
And to think we almost got Jim Carrey was almost not in this film. It was almost Nicolas Cage.
Oh, heavens.
Because this was right after Leaving Las Vegas, which I think was a 1994 and 1995 film that Nicolas Cage did. Nicolas Cage was the hot commodity. And before, he played every single role he could possibly get his hands on because of, you know, his financial advisor kind of screwed him out of all of his money. He was only taking, according to Michel Gondry, he would only take like about 1 out of 10 films that he was offered. And so he was kind of the hot commodity, and they asked him and he said no. And so they went with Jim Carrey. And I'm very thankful for that in hindsight, because poor Nicolas Cage has kind of turned into a meme in and of himself.
I'm looking up, when did National Treasure come out? Because I wonder if it was at the same time as this.
Oh man, if we would have lost National
it was the same year.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad he did National Treasure. The first one especially is so good.
Dude, role swap: Jim Carrey and National Treasure, and Nick Cage in this.
I think both movies would have suffered.
yes, you're absolutely right.
Both movies would have suffered. I think they got the casting right this time. Any other scenes, Brooker, before I transition into another science question for you?
No. I mean, the whole movie's great, but we hit all the scenes I wanted to talk about.
Okay, good. Here's a question for you. So I saw a study. This is a study back in 2014, mind you. So it's a dated study. But at MIT and apparently like a Japanese research facility teamed up to study memories in mice. And apparently they were able to erase bad memories from different rodents. And it was kind of paired with this whole study of, you know, post Eternal Sunshine and Spotless Mind being like, it's, you know, the science is getting closer and closer for us to be able to do this. Granted, just because we can do it in rodents doesn't mean we can do it in people, but that's kind of the gateway to human trials and things like that. Do you think in the near future that we will ever be able to erase memory? And you know, granted, they say we erase bad memories from these rodents. we don't know 100%, I guess, because rodents can't speak to us, and it's, you can't really measure memory. I don't even know how they did it. They just said that they did. But
well, there are different assays or experiments that you could do to actually measure memory, especially with mice. It's all like behavior. So it's kind of like, this is the only example I can think of currently, but it's kind of like, so it's kind of like fear. So fear is a memory. You remember being fearful of something, and it sounds cruel, but so these are kind of experiments that they can do. They'll put mice in a box, and they could receive like a small shock. Nothing like too harmful that will kill them, but like a small like shock, and they go, oh, okay. And they'll pair it with a stimulus,
mm-hmm.
like the color of the box, for example.
Sure.
And so they'll shock the mice, and then later on, so they've trained the mice to learn that this color is paired with this stimulus. Anyways, so they'll put the mice in that same color box, but not shock them, but they'll still be fearful because they remember this color.
Gotcha.
And they do this with different sort of different diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, things that affect memory. So those are why those experiments exist. It's not just to torture them.
Sure.
But so to your question, do you think that we would ever do that? I mean, I think you have to get through ethics, but I mean, it's probably possible. I mean, if we could do it in mice, I've been to science conferences where they've been able to see which cell the memory gets.
Wow.
Because like they could, I'm giving like a very half-assed answer to this because I'm just digging from my own memory.
No, that's
over a year ago.
Good. Yeah.
But yeah, they have some sort of device that they're able to hook up to the mice brain, and it kind of shows on this computer program kind of like, and like where all their neurons are and where there's activity, it'll kind of light up. And that's, and in this paradigm, it was like specific to like synapses forming, which means a memory is being made.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're able to like give it, they're able to have it do something, and then they're able to see in real time where in the head it was lighting up, where those synapses were being formed for this memory. Really cool stuff. Will they ever be able to do it for a human? I have no idea. It sounds painful. I don't know.
Yeah. That's interesting. Man, what a movie that you can both create deep intellectual and emotional conversations, and also it's the movie that inspired the song Gold Digger by Kanye West.
Is it really?
Yeah, so apparently Kanye West loved the score of this movie so much that he collaborated with the composer, John Bryan, and they, in their first sitting, they literally sat down to bounce around ideas. In their first sitting, they came up with the song Gold Digger.
Huh.
That's, which is just the most absurd thing I've ever heard.
I'm pretty sure that's a trivia fact that nobody from this movie wants, but that's...
It's just absurd to me, man. But yeah, this movie's layered. What can I say? On that note of how layered this movie is, Brooker, what do you think the meaning or the message of this movie is? And there are tens of, you know, hundreds of messages I'm sure could get from this movie. But for you, what would you say the message of this movie is?
I think that this movie is supposed to ask you one question, and it's like a cliche question, but this movie is, I think, supposed to make you think, is it better to have love and loss or never to have loved at all? I think that this I think this movie is very, very much promotes that kind of thinking, and it makes you think that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it necessarily provides an answer to that, but I think this movie is supposed to make you think about it.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree with you. I would agree with you. I had down memories are important because they make you who you are.
Oh, absolutely.
You were talking about it earlier about how it's like, I don't know if I would erase a memory of like an embarrassing thing or whatever. Like again, people have different experiences with emotions and sadness and anger and fear and regret. Like I get that sometimes crying can induce a less than positive reaction for some people, and other people can see it in a better light. I am a firm believer that there is beauty in shedding a tear. And if, you know, there is to go through pain. And, you know, pain is not good, obviously. Like, or I should say, no one is actively seeking out pain. You know, if you lose a family member, if you go through a breakup, or if you, you know, whatever life throws at you, like, obviously, no one is cheering whenever they lose someone that they care a lot about. But, and I've gone through my fair share, not to dive too, of trauma and pain. But if I could go back and change any of it, I've kind of concluded that I wouldn't, just because I know that every single piece of life that occurred that directly affected me, made me who I am mm-hmm. today. And so I think that if you take any bit of your life out, you are changing who you are now. And I think that, you know, the fact that you made it through, again, pain is hard, and you know, sometimes it's you know, making it through the pain is really, really difficult for some people. But if you make it through to the other side, that means that evolutionarily speaking, you made it through, and you are strong, and you were able to overcome this thing that the world tried to throw at you. And I think you're better off for it on the other side. You know, granted, that's a hot, kind of can be a hot button issue, but yeah, I would say that memories are important. Even if you have a breakup, it's better to have the lessons that you've learned and the experiences you've had with someone who, even, you know, in the long run, if Joel and Clem hadn't concluded, you know, if it concluded where they broke up and separated and that's it, and they stayed separated or whatever, Clem's still a sweet girl and Joel's still a sweet guy in their own right. And to have a memory of them to move forward with is still better than nothing.
Yeah, and I think that this movie both is showing that just as we're progressing through their relationship, we're seeing that they were great at one point. They kind of just, like they're good together. They just need a hard restart to remember why they were together. And so, yeah, that's kind of like what I got from this, too. But, no, I really like what your take, you know. Obviously, well, everybody makes mistakes, and there's things that we all want to forget, but ultimately, like you said, they make us who we are.
Yeah, I agree. Nice. Oh, very good consensus. I like it. All right. As we do with all of our episodes, the question must be asked. After we watch a movie, we wonder, does this movie need, deserve, require, do we want a sequel out of this film? Brooker, what do you think about a sequel?
No, I mean, this movie's fine how it is. I would like to see other, I like to see other in-universe cases that aren't relationship-based, just, you know, for, like, funsies. But, yeah, no sequel.
Yeah. Anytime I say no right off the bat, I think really, really hard, because I kind of try to muscle my way into figuring out what a good sequel would be. But I just cannot. I just can't. Know,
I think one just came to me. Let's make it like a crime movie.
Oh.
Like you go and not as simple as this, but kind of like, have you seen The Town with Ben Affleck? Maybe make it like some sort of like bank robbery movie. Like, you know, you got a whole group of guys, okay, or whatever, and you go and get your memory wiped and you have no memory of robbing the bank or how you did it or your accomplices, but you just have all this money for some reason. And then, like, you're being investigated by detectives, and it's maybe that would be kind of crazy or fun. Maybe that's a stupid idea.
I would be interested to see if they could somehow, how they would connect it to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind would be interesting, but I could definitely see that happening. So
I stole these panties. You're going.
She's a criminal. I would say, so I'll say it's a, I'm going to still keep it at a no, but I'll say it's a soft no. Just because of your creative juices are flowing, Brooker. Just for that.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Any other thoughts on this movie, Brooker, before we close it down?
No, this movie's good. I'm happy that it's in my top five Jim Carrey movies.
Mm-hmm. Unbiasedly, I think it's Jim Carrey's best. I think he did a great job going away from his bread and butter, kind of put in a box, but still did an amazing job. Well, if you made it this far, we really, really appreciate the listen. Thank you guys so much for all of you guys for sticking around. If this is your first time, thank you so much for joining us. And I would encourage you all to share us with a friend, family member, person you happen to meet at the beach that has crazy hair that you happen to strike a conversation up with on a train. Why not just be like, hey, check out Film on the Rocks. You can find us on essentially anywhere you can get podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, all of the great pod places, iTunes. Definitely check us out there. Feel free to email us on FOTRpodcast@gmail.com. If you have any comments or you want to get in touch with us or you have any movie ideas, we would love to hear any sort of suggestions. We love getting to hear from you guys. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're pretty active on there, putting up polls and what have you. We would love any sort of feedback you might have. But again, thank you guys for listening and for sticking with us in this little Jim Carrey ride we decided to take over the past few weeks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. And look out next week where we will be talking about, we'll have some special guests with us. We're going to be talking about Solo, a Star Wars movie. Or no, Solo, a Star Wars story. That's what it's called.
Finally, 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 a Star Wars movie. Did not think it would be Solo, but finally, after, you know, hey, we did Rise of Skywalker, but
in December, I'm ready to go.
I've been far, too far. Listen, I'm fine with it being in a galaxy far, far away, but I don't like my viewings to be in galaxies far, far away, if you know what I'm saying. I'm just ready for some Solo. Thank you guys for listening.
Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling.
Clementine. Bye, guys.
Bye.